U.S.-China tensions escalate again. From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio, who's on assignment. The U.S. is ordering China to close its consulate in Houston. The State Department isn't giving specifics other than saying it is to protect U.S. sovereignty and intellectual property. This comes as the Justice Department is indicting two Chinese hackers for trying to steal U.S. trade secrets and coronavirus research. China has called the accusations absurd and said it would retaliate for the consulate closure. Meanwhile, we've also got some big earnings reports coming out this week. Tesla reports earnings later today. Let's check in with Susan Schmidt, head of U.S. equities with Aviva Investors, as we always do, and see how markets are digesting all this. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
You know, we kind of rely on earnings reports from companies as a sort of little window into the health of large companies and the economy that they operate in. What are earnings reports telling us so far, and what do we expect to hear coming this week?
Today, Microsoft, Intel, Blackstone, Daimler, so a variety of industries. And this does help investors gain insight into different industries. It can provide a lot of comfort to the market when managements come out indicating that they have a plan and they can see the path forward for their businesses.
Tension between the U.S. and China is escalating. The U.S. just ordered the Chinese consulate to close in Houston in order to protect intellectual property, it said. What impact do you think that's going to have on markets moving forward?
Thus far, the markets seem to be ignoring that news and really focus on news about a vaccine, potential for another stimulus package. Remember that we're also in the middle of earnings, as you just mentioned, lots of data coming out. So investors have something to focus on. But it's important for people to keep in the back of their mind that the China trade tensions put a cloud over the entire market for most of 2019. And while it's being ignored now, we can't think about it as being totally pushed aside as we go forward.
Susan Schmidt, head of U.S. equities at Aviva Investors, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Twitter says it has removed thousands of accounts that spread conspiracy theories associated with the so-called QAnon movement. Social network is also promising sweeping actions to limit the spread of such content. Marketplace's Nova Sappho is here with the details. Hi, Nova.
Good morning.
What is QAnon and what is Twitter doing about it?
Right. So QAnon is a collection of conspiracy theories, but the main one being a global deep state conspiracy around child sex trafficking involving powerful political figures and celebrities. And supposedly President Trump is at the center of the fight against all of this. Now, this is complete nonsense. There's no basis in fact to any of this, but it's developed a following. Twitter says it's removed 7,000 accounts and is taking actions that could affect 150,000 others. It won't allow tweets that link to QAnon-related websites. It will not allow QAnon misinformation to appear on its Twitter trends, recommendations, or search results highlights.
These kinds of QAnon conspiracy theories, I mean, I remember hearing about them as far back as 2017. Mm-hmm. Why is Twitter doing this now?
Well, because Twitter says accounts associated with QAnon conspiracies have violated its terms by coordinating targeted online harassment of people, and sometimes these conspiracies have led to real-world violence since 2017, and we're seeing a lot of pressure on social media companies right now to act more aggressively to limit misinformation. There's an advertiser boycott off Facebook, as we know, where there's been reticence to take down content versus labeling and fact-checking it, although in May, Facebook did take down 5 QAnon-related pages, and reportedly, according to the New York Times, will be announcing similar moves as Twitter soon.
All right. Marketplace and Nova Sappho, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Facebook, meanwhile, is setting up teams to look at possible racial biases in its platforms, the Wall Street Journal is reporting. This includes examining whether or how algorithms and machine learning replicate or create racial biases, which they have been shown to do in some circumstances. Mutali Nakonde is a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard, where she researches the intersection of race and technology. We asked her about her expectations around this move.
They're pretty low, just because when I was reading about how this would be done, the teams that engage in this work have to get sign-off from their senior manager, and that immediately sent me to look at hiring, you know, diversity within the company. And it turns out in the last Facebook diversity report that I saw, which was from 2018, only 2% of that company worldwide are Black. And it wasn't clear to me whether the Black people within those roles were at that senior management level, nor from reading the article was it clear to me what senior management meant. Are you speaking to vice presidents? Are you speaking to managers? Are you speaking to directors?
Mitali Nkonde there, fellow at the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard. Let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 52 points. That is 0.2%. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are both up 0.2%. The 10-year Treasury yield is at 0.59% this morning. Pfizer and BioNTech SE will get $1.95 billion from the U.S. government in exchange for securing hundreds of millions of doses of a potential coronavirus vaccine that the government would then give to Americans for free. Both companies' stocks are up 5 to 6%. The pandemic has gutted the budgets of countries that depend on oil. Oil-rich countries have been talking for a while about transitioning away from petroleum, but it is so much easier said than done, and many were in no way prepared for the pandemic in that way. Roger McShane is Middle East editor for The Economist. He wrote about this in his recent article, There Will Be Pain. He joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just how bad has the coronavirus been for oil-rich countries?
I mean, it's been pretty bad. I don't want to overstate things. I mean, when sort of the price of oil futures went negative earlier in the year, that was obviously really bad. Now it's rebounded a lot. It's up to around $40, $45 for Brent crude, but that's still way below the sort of fiscal break-even price for many oil producers in the Middle East. I mean, nearly every oil exporting country in the region needs the price of oil to rise at least $10 in order to balance their books. So, you know, they're all in pretty bad shape when it comes to their budgets.
Haven't countries like Saudi Arabia been trying or hoping to move away from oil for years now, if not decades?
Yeah, I mean, if you look around the region, every country has, you know, a reform plan. But, you know, the rulers of Saudi Arabia have been talking about diversifying for decades, as you say. And there's more urgency now. There's been more urgency, I would say, over the past 5 years. And they've started to do things like, you know, recently raising the value-added tax. Other countries have cut back subsidies. I would just say that sort of to this point, they've been moving quite slowly. They've been sort of grabbing the low-hanging fruit. Part of this is that the public sector is still the region's main employer, and that's both in the oil-producing countries and in the non-oil-producing countries. And if you look at the Gulf, you know, their economies still revolve around oil. And right now, they are speaking about privatizing a bunch of different industries in order to raise revenue. And the question has to be asked, just sort of, why have they waited so long?
Well, right. I mean, what has been holding them back?
Part of it is that this is just really painful, a lot of these reforms. And certainly now that they're going to be harder to do while the price of oil is so low and there isn't a ton of money to sort of smooth the transition to less oily economies. But the crisis also sort of provides, I would say, an opportunity. You know, there is sort of this urgency, as I said, to sort of build more sustainable economies and more representative governments. But that also means rewriting the social contract. For decades, Arab rulers have sort of hoarded the wealth and sort of bought loyalty by providing free services and government jobs. Now, if all of a sudden they're going to be providing fewer government jobs, and all of a sudden the services are going to cost money, and they're going to provide fewer subsidies, all of a sudden the people might think, okay, well, you're asking us to sacrifice, but you're giving us no say in the matter. You know, we want a say in the matter, which means more representative government. And we'll just see how Arab leaders react to that.
Roger McShane, Middle East editor for The Economist. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.